From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When the 109th Congress convenes tomorrow in Washington, there will be a sea of Republicans on Capitol Hill. The GOP controls both the House and Senate by even bigger margins since November and holds the keys to the Oval Office. Democrats are definitely the lesser power. Even so, the parties are sure to fight over the president's proposed changes for Social Security and lock horns on judicial nominees. But all the fighting may not be along party lines. In recent weeks, Republicans have shown cracks in the united front that swept them to dominance. They openly squabbled over the intelligence bill. Some of the GOP's most prominent figures called for Donald Rumsfeld to resign. Others are second-guessing Social Security reform. For his part, President Bush has outlined a big agenda for his second term and doesn't want to play lame duck. Today, he turned up the charm and a little heat when he welcomed freshman lawmakers to Washington.
You know, I've learned a lot about Washington in 4 years. This town is sometimes too partisan and too political. People sometimes say what's more important than the country is my politics. And my hope is that we can show the nation that we can come together to achieve big things for the good of the country.
Big things for the good of the country. Tonight on Point, Congress and the Bush agenda, fault lines, power plays, and pitfalls on their way in the 109th Congress. You can join the conversation tonight with the GOP in power. At both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue, is passage of the Bush agenda a done deal? Will Congress enact the Bush vision? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight from Washington is Gail Shattuck, congressional reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, wonderful to have you with us tonight. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be here.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Happy New Year, Jack. Wonderful to have you as well.
Happy New Year to you and to you too, Gail.
So, there you are. The crowds are assembling in Washington. It all begins again tomorrow. Everything was focused pretty much on the election for months in the last Congress. What do the battle lines look like within and without the Republican Party as this Congress comes to sit down in the House and Senate?
I think the biggest one is going to be between Republicans and Democrats over the legacy of the New Deal. This is huge. It extends from Social Security and regulation reform all the way through taxes and a whole redesign of government. There's an equally interesting battle going on for the soul of the Republican Party. On the one hand, you have the conservatives who were part of the 94 revolution, including some very interesting ones returning to the Senate, who want to go back to the ideals of limited government and lower spending. So the president is going to face both opposition from Democrats and a very difficult time holding the Republicans together. There's a kind of odd law of politics that the larger the margins, the more difficult a president has holding his coalition together. That may well prove to be the case here.
So there's a lot on the table right there, the legacy of the New Deal and the soul of the Republican Party. We'll dive into all that. But, Gail, I wish you'd just take us on a kind of a checklist down the major items that President Bush wants to push through in this second term that he'll need the help of Congress on. What does it look like in a kind of roughly descending priority here?
Well, he would like to start immediately talking about Social Security, tax reform, of course, the war, a tidal wave that nobody expected, getting into regulatory reform, and transforming the courts with some judicial nominations. He signaled early on he's going to go back to 20 of his nominees that didn't get through in the last Congress, and with an additional four Republicans in the Senate, he's looking for a better prospect for getting them through.
All that plus reform of immigration laws, an energy bill to be pushed again.
And the old issues, exactly.
Right,
energy,
still there.
The highway bill, immigration, and don't forget the Patriot Act, provisions of which are due to expire this year, which is always good for a lively debate.
So he's got, it's a big agenda, as you say, going right all the way back to the sort of fundamental assumptions of the New Deal. How are they beginning to approach this? Even as we sit here tonight, they must have been thinking for a while now about how they're going to deal with this bigger Republican majority. What's their strategy?
Well, I think the Senate side has a very difficult problem. Not only are they coming at this with fewer members, but they have hanging over their head the specter of Tom Daschle, who was their leader, who very unusually lost in his reelection bid. So the albatross of being obstructionist is not one that any of them want to hold on to. I think they're counting, in a way, on divisions within the Republican Party to help them. And they're looking for an image that is both conciliatory, moderate, but willing to be tough on what they see as tough, principled issues. The first one they're likely to face, and the very most difficult for many in that Democratic Party, are going to be judicial nominations, because the Republicans are threatening what they're calling the nuclear option, which is a bid to actually lower the threshold needed to stop debate from 60 to a simple majority. If that happens, Democrats say, they're going to bring this chamber to a halt, which would be a very bad way to start.
So Republicans now with 55 seats in the Senate, of course, it takes a 60 to what, overrule a filibuster or get past it. The Democrats saying that are threatening to use that if President Bush tries to push through the same slate of judicial appointments that he raised in his first term?
That's right. Now, they're not – it's the tone is interesting when you talk to them. They're not coming out and with the sign of waving sabers. What's interesting is what is not being said right now. There is a lot of talk about, you know, waiting and seeing what that first nomination looks like. The first one is very important. The Senate Majority Leader, Bill Frist, is now saying that he doesn't plan to go ahead with this so-called nuclear option until he sees what Democrats do on that first nomination.
So there's a kind of dance here. Meanwhile, on the House side, there's been all kinds of conversation about ethics recently. You mentioned the Republican class of 94 that came in accusing the Democrats of having debauched the Congress and implementing tougher ethics rules. The Republicans now looking to loosen a lot of ethics rules with their own Tom Daschle in trouble. Tom DeLay in trouble.
That's right. Many of the Republicans who aren't speaking on the record about this yet are very dismayed by this first vote, effectively lowering the ethics standards. It's going on as we speak. What they're planning on doing is, for example, changing the rules on how the Ethics Committee functions from going ahead if there's a tie vote to ending an investigation if there's a tie vote. This is one of the few House committees that's actually equally divided. So they're also proposing exempting lawmakers from a standard that members should conduct themselves at all times in a manner that reflects credibly on the House. That's a standard that's in a lot of business and in the military, kind of blanket statement.
And you're saying they're looking to excise that. They're looking to take that standard away.
Right. It's not enough to behave in a way that doesn't reflect creditably on the House. You actually have to break a regulation or a rule. Now, there are
As it stands now, it's the tougher line, and you're saying the GOP wants to loosen that, wants to take that away. So even if it doesn't look good, that's all right.
That's all right. You have to actually break a regulation or a rule. So you've got public interest groups today, eight in Washington, holding briefings saying, you know, this is arrogant and it's unacceptable to lower this standard at a time when the American people have voted on morality as their number one concern.
Jack Beatty,
as a Republican aide said to me today, the visuals on this one are not good.
and probably won't be many of them if they can duck the cameras. Jack Beatty, here it is, President Bush pulling up some pretty heavy items in his second-term agenda, some even transformational items, as Gil Chadwick says. Meanwhile, the Democrats trying to figure out how to resist without being labeled obstructionist and drummed out of Congress like Tom Daschle was, and Republicans with fissures of their own.
Yes, and with risks of their own. You know, in the 2000 campaign, Al Gore called the scheme the idea of privatizing Social Security a risky scheme. Of course, at that time, we had a surplus that would allow one to make the transition. Now we have a huge deficit. We'd have to borrow $2 trillion to do it. It's even an even riskier scheme. But if it's risky in a policy sense, it's really risky politically. Under one version of this, guaranteed benefits to recipients would be cut by 40%. Now, Ray LaHood, the Republican from Illinois, recently said, my gosh, can you imagine the 10-second ad? My opponent wants to cut your Social Security 40%. Going to be tough for him to say, no, 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 I don't mean current people, and I don't even want to cut it 40%. You see, we may have to, in other words, it's a horrible situation for an incumbent politician in a even slightly marginal district. Now, the question, of course, about congressional districts is, are any of them marginal? That is to say, does it matter anymore?
With 97, 98 re-election rates of sitting congressmen.
I mean, maybe that's out the window, but there is a precedent. In 1982, Tip O'Neill got 26 Republicans out of the Congress just on Social Security. He nationalized the campaign, the midterm campaign around Social Security. The Republicans impolitically, but I think correctly, wanted to limit cost of living adjustments, and that was that. And it worked. Now, will it work this time for the Democrats? I don't know, but it is risky for Republicans in any sort of district where there are a lot of senior citizens and or where folks aren't as ideologically inclined.
And yet the nation's ideological inclinations have changed a fair bit since 1982 and the first years of the Reagan presidency. Gil Chadwick, Jack Beatty, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation now from Washington, from Highland Park, New Jersey, Ross Baker. He's professor of political science at Rutgers University, author of House and Senate, a close watcher of the U.S. Senate. Ross Baker, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks very much for having me.
We just heard Gil Chadwick say that we've got Democrats who want to oppose President Bush but are afraid of meeting the Tom Daschle end, being tarred as obstructionist and losing their own seats. Do you expect a vigorous Democratic opposition to the Bush agenda in this term, or are they running scared?
I think that the opposition is going to be calibrated. I think there are certain things that the Democrats will probably yield on. And other things, I think that they will put up a pretty spirited defense against. For example, I think that many people feel that the president may get tort reform, although oddly enough, he may get opposition from senators in his own party, like Lindsey Graham of North Carolina, Richard Shelby of Alabama, both of whom were trial lawyers before they came to the Senate. Nonetheless, I think there's a feeling that perhaps this is a proposal that has a better chance of passing. Another thing that the Democrats seem to be inclined to yield on is drilling for oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. That seems to be something else that the president might just get. However, so far as bringing back the 10 failed circuit court nominees and hoping that somehow they'll get better treatment, I think is really quite unrealistic on the part of the White House.
These the 10 that the Democrats opposed to the bitter end in the first term.
In the 108th Congress, mm-hmm. Right, exactly. And so I think that on judicial nominations, I think the Democrats are definitely going to hold the line. And as far as Social Security is concerned, I think if you believe what Senator Harry Reid, the new Democratic leader of the Senate, said, this is definitely a line in the sand that they have drawn with considerable eagerness. They really do want the president to push ahead with this. He's given it priority. And I think that by simply delaying it and deferring any kind of action on Social Security until the eve of the 2006 election, I think puts the Democrats in a very good position to use one of their most venerable and effective weapons on the Republicans, and that, of course, is that they're out to wreck Social Security.
What do you think, Gil Chadwick? Does it still have the legs that it had in 1982? Is there a Tip O'Neill reversal, a jujitsu to be done here on the Republicans, or have they got the country more ideologically at this point on their side?
Well, I think you can't underestimate the power of the senior lobby, and it'll be very interesting to see how the AARP goes on this. They're already coming out in opposition to it.
Mm-hmm.
The president had them with him on Medicare, and they're a very powerful group to cross. It depends on how aggressively they push it. And remember, you're in a context of a war and massive deficits. He'll have to at some point explain where the $1 or $2 trillion are going to come from to pay for it.
The big couple of trillion to privatize or begin privatizing Social Security. Gil Chadwick, Ross Baker, Jack Beatty, please stand by. We're talking tonight about Congress and the Bush agenda. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. What's the issue that you're watching most closely as this Congress gets rolling? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Congress and the Bush agenda, fault lines, power plays, and pitfalls on the way in the 109th Congress, which will convene tomorrow. We're joined tonight by Gail Chadwick. She covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. Ross Baker at Rutgers University is with us. You can join us as well. With the GOP in power at both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue, is the Bush agenda a done deal? Or do you expect some Republican rebellion? And what about the Democrats? Do they have a darn thing to say about how the country is run now? And what strategy do you suggest for the Dems, cooperation or confrontation? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined right now from Topeka, Kansas, by Senator Sam Brownback, Republican senator, first elected to Congress in 1994, moved to the Senate in 1996. In the upcoming 109th Congress, he will serve on the Judiciary and Appropriations Committees. Good evening and welcome, Senator Sam Brownback.
Good evening. How are you doing?
We're doing terrifically. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. We last spoke when you were at the Republican convention, and things have gone pretty well for your party since then. How do you look ahead to this this 109th Congress and President Bush's agenda? Do you think the president will be supported?
Yes, but I think it's going to be things that you're going to see happen in the Congress that have been worked on for some period of time that'll be coming forward. Energy policy, which we desperately and clearly need. Immigration reform. Our immigration system is broken down desperately. The tax reform, fundamental tax reform. Social Security. The system is not set for the baby boomers to fully retire and the generation coming along behind them. Tort reform. These are big topics. There will be a lot of give and take on getting them moved forward, but I think most people would agree all need to be addressed along with the judiciary.
Senator Brownback, where do you see the most unanimity within the Republican Party, on the Republican side of the aisle, on these issues? Which issues are going to be easiest for the president and the leadership on Capitol Hill? Which are going to be most difficult?
Probably energy is easiest for as far as unity amongst the Republican Party. It's clearly a need. It's something we've run into and tried to pass a couple of times. I think we get it done, and I think we can get it done well. The most difficult topic is probably immigration. Again, the system's broken, but there are differing views on how to fix it. I think you're going to have to look at a combination of something along the line of what the president's visiting about and increased enforcement as a tandem to be able to get that through.
In other words, more liberal in some sense on allowing workers to come in a documented way, but tougher on border control and patrol?
Yes, I think you're going to have something that both sides feel like, well, I'm getting something that I think is important to deal with a problem that is enormous in this country today.
Senator Brownback, during the Republican convention, you were quoted at a meeting of Christian conservatives in New York City saying, we've got to get the majorities we need, we've got to get the White House, we've got to win the culture war and push through the conservative agenda that's been waiting too long. Can you do that? Now, you've got significant majorities in both houses of Congress. You've got the White House. Is this the conservatives' day? Is a new United States going to emerge from this next 4 years?
I do think you've seen fundamental changes taking place in the country, and now the nation is majority pro-life, if you define that as being opposed to abortion, other than in cases of rape, incest, and life of the mother. It's a pro-life country. It's a country that supports traditional marriage. And the, I believe, 13 states that have voted directly on this, it's passed in every state, normally by very large margins. So I think you will see those agenda items coming forward. But I think there'll be it will probably not be the direct frontal approach immediately. It'll be things like the Unborn Pain Awareness Act, about informing mothers about the pain that a child experiences if they're 20 weeks along going through abortion. It'll be states dealing with marriage. We will bring it up, and it'll be a big topic in judicial nominations. I think that's how you'll see some of these issues be expressed.
Now, you're going to be on the Judiciary Committee. That could be an early flashpoint. The Democrats are threatening explicitly or implicitly to filibuster President Bush's nominees. Bill Frist, your leader in the Senate there, is saying we may have to resort to changing the rules so that we can not be hindered by a filibuster on judicial nominees. What do you anticipate on that front?
I think if the Democrats continue on this tactic of blocking judicial nominees by filibuster, which you got to remember, the role of the Senate in judicial nominees is advice and consent, not filibuster. And I think you will see if they continue to take this tactic, I think it will not go over well with the public, and that you will see the Senate move to change the filibuster rules regarding judges so that it would get down to a majority and not be held up by the supermajority of 60 votes before you can get a judge through.
And finally, Senator Brownback, on Social Security, the president's done a lot of spade work to try and create public support for the elements of privatization he wants to introduce, yet it's always been a kind of third rail. What about Republican solidarity on this front? Are your Republican colleagues going to have the nerve, the courage, whatever, call it what you will, to go forward on the president's proposed Social Security reforms?
I think so. I've been campaigning on this topic for several years and talking across my state and in other venues about it. It is something that needs to take place. Everybody agrees the current system does not work when you have the baby boomers fully retired. The sooner you address it, the more options you have and the less difficulty in implementing those options. And I do think the country has changed over the last 10 years, where 10 years ago this was clearly a third rail. Now there's much more acceptance that, yes, something needs to be done in this system.
Senator Brownback, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Tom. Take care.
You bet. Senator Sam Brownback of Kansas, Republican senator, will be joining the 109th Congress on the Judiciary and Appropriations Committee. Gail Chadwick, there's a voice of a rather prominent Republican senator, and he's expressing confidence. Of course, he would and would have to, but it's a complicated situation they're going into, but he's saying we're going to do it.
I was actually very interested to hear what he said on those fronts. He, of course, on the point of advice and consent, he's absolutely right. But what Democrats would say about it is there has to be some advising going on as well. President Clinton talked to Republicans when he made his nominations and often would choose, you know, a moderate after you know, Republicans on the Judiciary Committee had some objections. Mm-hmm. So where is the advice is what Democrats are going to say. But the other thing, and this I think is we're in uncharted territory, so no one knows quite what it will look like. But assume the Republicans do pass this law and Democrats make good or this change in the rules on filibusters and Democrats make good on their threat to just refuse every unanimous consent request that's made. The Senate runs on unanimous consent. You can't get anything done without it. And the options in the vast number of Senate procedures for obstruction are legion.
So they really do have the potential, the capacity to essentially shut down the Senate.
Absolutely.
Even in a minority. Ross Baker, how do you see, you heard Senator Brownback there expressing a general confidence, but on abortion and maybe on some other things as well, saying they won't take the direct funnel approach, if I heard him correctly. In other words, they're going to chip away at some things. Do you see... at the same time, you know, he maybe above all has been talking with religious conservatives and saying we're going to come through for you in these next few years here. So how do you see it? A transformational Congress in second Bush term or avoiding that direct approach?
I think perhaps a confrontational Congress is perhaps a more accurate description. I think that particularly in the case of the filibuster, I think that the filibuster is something which I think is generally conceded is widely abused. It isn't really used for important issues anymore. It's used for practically anything. Senators are disturbed by some minor infraction or some affront to their dignity. They'll use the filibuster. But it's a device that's available to any senator. And I think when senators begin to reflect on how convenient it is for them to have it, to have their own nuclear weapon, the idea of reducing their ability to have recourse to the filibuster, I think will cause them to back off. I think a lot of a lot of this talk about the so-called nuclear option, that is having the presiding officer declare the filibuster to be unconstitutional, is basically a lot of posturing on the part of Bill Frist.
That Republicans themselves will not want to surrender that weapon. They might want it one day to use.
That's exactly right. I think it doesn't take a great deal of imagination on the part of Republicans to imagine that they might be in that situation. And it's not even a partisan thing, Tom. It's an individual thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the things that gives senators stature and power and influence that make them feel, as Henry Adams once said, as occupying one of the dogmatic stations of life in America.
And the loss of a kind of diminishment of that stature, certainly of that even that individual power. Ross Baker, Gail, stand by. I want to begin to get our callers in here. Mike is calling from Stuart, Florida. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think the Democrats need to stand up, you know, take a lesson from Russ Feingold, who faced re-election this last go-round.
Mm.
He voted against the Patriot Act. He voted against the war. He consistently has voted liberal progressive issues. And the Republicans targeted him this time. And he spoke clearly and upfront about why he made the votes he made. And he won by a bigger margin this time than he did 6 years ago. And if Republicans, you know, or Democrats rather have the guts to follow his lead, I think they do a hell of a lot better than trying to be Republican-like.
So you say, look at Russ Feingold, never mind Tom Daschle, who is now out on his ear.
Right. Yeah, look at Russ Feingold. He's my leading light of the Democratic Party these days.
Mike, we've got it, and thanks very much for your call. Gail, how about the Democrats' sense of fight? You know, we're hearing tonight that this, you expressed it yourself, that nobody wants to be the next Tom Daschle. Is there a real fear of being labeled obstructionist by the Republican Party and paying a price for that in 2006? Or is there a sense that there are enough voters like Mike out there who want to see them stand up, you know, stick their chin out and go for it?
I think Mike is going to be very pleased with how the Democrats respond. Harry Reid is an amateur boxer.
Nevada Senator, Minority Leader.
Exactly. Dick Durbin is one of the shrewdest politicians the Democrats have, and they both have a persona that is not a fire eater. I think you'll see great toughness there, but with a procedural sophistication that is going to be fairly effective. I don't write the Democrats off at all.
Ross Baker, how do you see it on that front? You know, is there a sense that the Democrats can only be so fierce in opposition, or that they need to be more fierce in opposition?
Well, I really agree with Gail. I think that Harry Reid was the minority whip in the Senate, and Harry Reid is somebody who really knows floor procedures. That is, he's somebody who really is a parliamentarian.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't many of them around. There aren't many of them in the Senate. Robert Byrd is probably the only other senator who would sort of rise to the dignity of that. But I think that with someone like that, who's basically making strategy and having and being backed up by an extremely astute and articulate whip and Dick Durbin, I think that the Democrats really do have an opportunity to stand toe-to-toe with the Republicans. I think that some Democrats will be intimidated. I think that certainly the Republicans are putting a lot of heat on Ben Nelson, who is a Democratic senator from Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
The Reverend James Dobson from the
Focus on the Family, the Christian group out of Colorado Springs.
Exactly, yeah. You know, has made some threatening gestures in his direction. And certainly Nebraska is not a normally strong Democratic state.
Mm.
So, you know, Nelson does have something to worry about. But I think that certainly Democratic senators who represent states which are more typically Democratic and who won by fairly large margins are going to be every bit as resolute. I mean, I can't imagine anyone intimidating Senator Charles Schumer or Senator Ted Kennedy. Or Senator John Kerry, for that matter.
Jack Beatty, of course, on the other hand, they don't have to intimidate all the senators, just enough to make sure that what they want goes through.
Well, that's right. I mean, you've got some Southerners who are coming up for re-election someplace in there. That's going to be tough. Any senator from a red state, and I would look for someone like Evan Bayh, who who really strikes me as a man who gives caution a bad name. But I would look for someone like that to come forward on Social Security and
the Indiana moderate Democrat senator.
Make a gesture toward the president and say, well, you know, we need to reform this system. And so I can imagine some of those senators looking for that sort of Joe Lieberman. I could imagine him doing it. Maybe I'm wrong on that. Maybe the Democrats are going to get religion on this and recognize that the Bush case on the numbers is so dubious that they can actually take this to the country in an election and win on it, even in tough places.
Dave's calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi. I think Jack's absolutely right. And it's a matter of the way the Democrats phrase it. For instance, when you asked Senator Sam Brownback
yes.
whether the Republicans would have the nerve and the courage to push Social Security, if I were the Democrats, I would phrase it saying, do the Republicans have the gall and the chutzpah to make the tax cuts permanent, yet to then push Social Security privatization and actually phase out of Social Security?
But, Dave, of course, they've got majorities in both parties. How pugnacious do you sense the Democrats these days being?
I don't sense the Democrats have any guts at all, but I wish they would have. I've been appalled at how they've rolled over for the Republicans on most issues. And I would truly hate to see them roll over on Social Security when the numbers, as Jack said, don't justify it, as Paul Krugman has pointed out many times.
New York Times columnist, including on this show. Dave, thanks very much for calling. Russ Baker, I wonder, you know, President Bush in his first term, there were a number of times when he'd reach for the moon and then be satisfied with getting halfway there, but halfway was a lot. Sam Brownback saying, well, you know, the things that we're pretty sure we're going to get, like tort reform, like a new energy bill, drilling in Anwar. Not so long ago, these things were in themselves huge lines in the sand.
Well, I think the Democrats are in a difficult position. On the one hand, they do really need to avoid simply being obstructionist, simply opposing everything. That's the reason why I feel that they're going to give ground on things like on the energy bill and perhaps on tort reform. On the other hand, I think that if they choose their targets astutely, as I think they will, I think they can really be a formidable obstacle to some of the president's more ambitious proposals. For example, the president has already said that he's going to put off a consideration of large-scale tax reform, mm-hmm. or actually restructuring the tax code.
For another year, anyway.
For another year, anyhow. And the reason for that, of course, is because with taxes, it's very clear almost immediately who the winners and losers are.
Right. It's in the bill.
Right. With Social Security, it's a little, you know, it deals much more with future benefits.
And it is decades away. Ross Baker, Gail Chadwick, Jack Beatty, standby. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about Congress and the Bush agenda. Well, the 109th Congress convenes tomorrow. What do you think? Will this Congress enact the Bush vision? Will Bush's second term be transformational or lame duck? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about Congress and the Bush agenda, about fault lines and power plays and pitfalls on the way in the 109th Congress. It will convene tomorrow. You can join our conversation tonight. What do you think? The Republicans control both houses of Congress. Is the Bush agenda, therefore, a done deal? And where do you see the strengths and the fault lines in the Republican Party? And what do you suggest for the Democrats? Cooperation or confrontation or obstruction? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joined tonight from Highland Park, New Jersey, by Ross Baker, professor of political science at Rutgers University. From Washington, by Gail Chadwick. She covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. Our own Jack Beatty is with us as well. And right now, Peter is calling from Boston. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a comment first about history that I hope the Democratic Party is paying attention to. In terms of the behavior of Jesse Helms in the Judiciary Committee when he was the leading Republican, principally in the minority, where he was perfectly willing to bring Congress absolutely to a halt over judicial nominations during the Clinton years and even before that.
Not the least bit shy about doing that.
Oh, and very skilled, very adept at it, and was absolutely forthright about that being purely politically motivated, having nothing to do with judiciary behavior at all, judicial behavior at all.
Cross Jesse Helms and he would cross you back, and you're saying Democrats take a leaf from that book?
Absolutely. That is how the Senate works and has always been effective.
Fighting words.
And that's how the Democratic Party, I believe, has a chance to actually redefine itself, is not by rolling over the Democratic Party got where it is today by trying to be Republican. It has no hope of surviving as a party. You know, look at how many the few blue states that are left. I believe it has absolutely no hope of surviving unless it can reinvigorate its appeal to the working people of America. And the big fault of the party has been to allow the Republicans to paint the label of weak on defense and somehow take away the notion that individual rights matter.
Peter, we got it. We hear it loud and clear. Gail Chadwick, you hear that kind of fighting spirit in what Peter's saying from a Democrat perspective. Do you feel that on Capitol Hill, or are Democrats making a more, a nuanced calculation about what their constituencies want? Do they feel the nerve or the courage to take that position that Peter's recommending?
I'm hearing there is certainly an attitude of waiting for events to help. Events like, how is the war in Iraq really going? What's really happening with jobs? What does the economy look like? What's happening with deficits? The president and the Republicans had projections on all those fronts.
Mm-hmm.
Are they being realized or not?
So in other words, not a readiness to stand up and make a kind of a principled counterattack, but to wait for the events to come in as reinforcement for them.
I think that's what the Democrats are going to do. Mm. However, as Peter was talking about Jesse Helms, it struck me that there is a Jesse Helms in this Congress, incoming Congress. He's, a Republican. His name is Tom Coburn from Oklahoma.
Mm.
And I think the Republican leaders are more concerned about him than they are the Democratic leaders, because this is a real conservative. I mean, he when he was in the House, he held up appropriations in agriculture for a year because he just didn't believe in agricultural subsidies. And with the powers that a senator has and his very strict conservative small government convictions, I think he could be quite a figure in the next Congress.
Jack Beatty, what do you expect in terms of the kind of fire-eating opposition from Democrats? Do you feel it out there, or a more cautious approach?
Well, you know, let's look ahead. Some of these guys want to run for president in 2008. Mm-hmm. And if the war is still on, then I hope to God it's not. I hope we're out of there. But if we're still there, this will be the main issue in the Democratic primary.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Democrats had a similar situation in 1969. And among them, the one who was strongest on get out of Vietnam, George McGovern, went to the head of the pack for the 72 primaries.
Mm-hmm.
And he did it by essentially talking to the base of the Democratic Party. That vote is available. And I would predict some ambitious senator, if we head up toward 3,000, God help us, 4,000 casualties, somebody's going to stand up in that Senate and say no.
But we all know what happened to George McGovern, and the Democrats remember it vividly.
Yeah, but that was a different situation entirely, running against an incumbent president who could fix up the economy to get through an election, do price controls and so on. Very different. It's going to be an open seat in 2008. And the public is already turned against this war.
Yeah, you see that in the polls. Brian's calling from Wauzeka, Wisconsin. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Good evening. I just wanted to say that half of this country that voted for Kerry were predicting dire things from President Bush. I don't think that it is anything that the Democrats need to do. I think the Bush administration will prove itself.
You think it's going to fall on its own weight, that they can wait for events?
I predict a big scandal in the presidency. And the Iraq war is going to wear down on the American people.
Yeah, if it goes on. Of course, they could try and turn things another way. But, Brian, thanks for your call. Russ Baker, take us inside the Republican Party a little bit. There's been a lot of talk about fault lines there. It was a tough battle to get the intelligence bill passed. There's been sniping at the president's man at the Defense Department, Donald Rumsfeld, recently talk about a deal on the immigration front, that Bush wouldn't push so hard for liberalization there in return for support on the intelligence side. How serious do you see the fault lines within the Republican Party?
Oh, I think they're considerable. And I think, for example, there's a basic fault line, and that is between the social conservatives in the Republican Party and the economic conservatives. For the social conservatives, you know, the principal issues are abortion and same-sex marriage and so on. For the economic conservatives, and these are the most traditional Republicans, they're concerns about the deficit. They're concerns about the economy generally. And I think that there's some very unsettling signs. They're concerned about the size of the deficit. They're concerned about the fact that any change in Social Security will be funded by debt. So I think there's definitely a fault line there, certainly on immigration. Congressman Sensenbrenner of Wisconsin, of course, was basically one of the two members of Congress who held up the intelligence bill over immigration, and Sensenbrenner has simply laid it down as a principle that that illegal aliens will be denied driver's licenses by the state. This will be mandated. And that's going to come up, and it's going to cause problems. On the one hand, the Republicans were very happy with the degree of support they got from Latino voters. On the other hand, there are lots of Republicans who live in gated communities in Florida and Arizona who are most uneasy about not just immigration, but about what they see as the loss of the English language as the preeminent mode of communication in the United States. So I can see all kinds of problems, leaving the Democrats aside. And this, I think, is very often what happens when a party feels that it's dominant, suffers from triumphalism, as I think the Republicans are now.
Gil Chadwick, how about it? Internal tensions within the Republican Party. Ross Baker says he sees the social conservatives versus the economic conservatives. How acute is that tension on Capitol Hill? There was a pretty successful unified front before the November election. Can it hold?
I think it held precisely because of the November election. Now that that's over, it's a very different landscape, and people are talking openly about that. Look at Mike Pence, an Indiana lawmaker who's head of the Republican study group in the House, the largest conservative caucus. I mean, this is someone who absolutely couldn't be swayed in his opposition to the Medicare bill and is now really going forward to try to push a conservative agenda. They're not held back by the need to get a president in who can make judicial nominations.
So how do you call it, Gail? Overall, we just got a minute left here. If you look ahead, do you see President Bush coming out of this, the transformational president, with the Republican Congress having helped him push through this full agenda, or do you see a kind of patchwork of successes and failures emerging?
I think the tidal wave is a nice metaphor for this administration. Facts happen. You have to respond to them. I think Iraq and the deficit and jobs are going to be three 500-pound gorillas in the room that he's going to have to respond to. It's going to make all of these, the rest of the program, very difficult.
Ross Baker, just half a minute here. What do you foresee? Big success for Bush with his big agenda or something less?
No, I agree with Gail. I think that the context has to be thrown in. And you know, Iraq is the dreaded four-letter word. And I think that much of what goes on is going to be shaped by what happens at the election on the 30th of January and beyond.
Yeah, and we see the headlines coming every day now with a dozen, two dozen dead. It's not a good piece of ticker tape coming across there. Ross Baker at Rutgers University, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
And Gail Chadwick, Christian Science Monitor on Capitol Hill. Always great to have you. Thanks very much for being here, Gail.
Thank you, Tom.
Jack Beatty, we've just got 20 seconds here, but there's that big agenda. You know President Bush will push it, and there's reality right on the other side.
There sure is, and there's the fact that he won by 2% of the vote. Ronald Reagan, re-election, 18%. Richard Nixon, 23%. Dwight Eisenhower, 16%. Teddy Roosevelt, 17%. Lowest Republican re-election of the century. So he doesn't have a big mandate on domestic policy, that's for sure.
Not that huge margin. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank
Listeners,
you.
In a moment, we remember Congressman Robert Matsui. This is On Point. California Congressman Robert Matsui died on Saturday. He was 63 years old and died of a rare type of bone marrow cancer. Matsui had served in Congress for 26 years. Most recently, he was the Democrats' point man on Social Security. In the weeks before his death, he seemed eager to lead the fight against Republican proposals for partial privatization of that program. Matsui was also an outspoken leader for Japanese Americans. As an infant during the Second World War, he was sent to an internment camp with his family. He worked throughout his life to gain recognition for the tens of thousands of other Japanese Americans who had shared that fate. On November 4, 2001, he spoke about that lifelong effort at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston. Here's an excerpt of that speech.
I'd like, if I may, to take a moment to read something that I was able to get through the Freedom of Information Act in 1992. Individual number 25261C, file number 405986, year of birth 41, relocation center Tule Lake, assembly center Pinedale, home address Sacramento, California. Country of birth of father, U.S. mainland. Country of birth of mother, U.S. mainland. Birthplace, California. Year of arrival, American born, never in Japan. Marital status, single. Languages, not applicable. Race, Japanese and no spouse. Highest grade, no schooling or kindergarten. That happened to be my file that is still in the Defense Department of the United States government. I was 6 months old at the time that I was taken with my mother and father from Sacramento, California, and placed in internment camps in the United States. I was never given a trial. I never went before any magistrate, nor did my parents. And to this day, I do not know what the charges that were lodged against me nor my deceased parents at this time. This is a great and wonderful country, because what happened in 1987 is that the House, the United States House of Representatives and the United States Senate passed legislation for a presidential apology for the internment for the surviving Americans of Japanese ancestry who were interned, plus compensation of $20,000 per survivor. President Reagan signed the legislation, and I have to say that I brought the letter from the president. It was by that time President Bush Sr. had signed the letter and gave it to my father, who was 21 years old at the time of the internment. And he broke down and cried. And he indicated what a great country we had. And I have to say that it's very few countries that are willing to look back in its past and apologize for its acts or make amends for its acts, as the United States has done. And hopefully, as a country, that we learn from our mistakes of the past. And that's why it's my strong belief and my strong hope that what happened to us will not happen to any other American or resident alien in this country, and certainly not to the Arab American community.
Congressman Robert Matsui in a speech from November 2001. Matsui died Saturday. He was 63 years old. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.